Taped from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, the show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
And I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
Hey, Darren, how you doing today?
I'm doing well. I'm doing fantastic, because we got a guest in the room with us tonight, in the virtual room.
Yeah, we certainly do. We certainly do. We've got, we always enjoy interviewing folks from the behind the scenes of SNL. And this week we've got a production designer from SNL's film unit. We have Andrea Persigliotti.
Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much, Andrea. Thanks for joining us.
Of course. Happy to be here.
Yeah,
absolutely. Good to have you here. And also, we should mention that you are a recent Emmy winner. You fresh off the Emmys. Fantastic.
It was really, really unexpected. I tripped over my words. I was blindsided. Historically the film unit, you know, hasn't as much of part of SNL as it is. It definitely, you know, wasn't included in the Emmy nods from years past. So it was, quite nice to be included. Even crazier to win.
Now, why were they not included before? Was that some sort of technical thing? Was it like a reclassification or anything like that?
I think it part and parcel has to do with the fact that, you know, the live show takes precedence. It is definitely the bulk of time. You know, if you're looking at it just strategically from a time involvement, the live show, you know, is the more dominant feature of the show, and the pre-tape stuff is a vehicle for the live show to, in fact, be a live show. You know, it was engineered into the show as a part of the breaks because, you know, the commercial breaks. That's what I'm trying to say. And didn't allow for the scenic changes, the costume, wardrobe, makeup, you know, any type of, you know, transitions that needed to happen in between the acts, wasn't enough. So from what I'm told, you know, even back into the early days of the pre-tapes is that, you know, short films or commercials helped give the live show the time that it needed. So I think based on that, in terms of like the politics of the Emmys, that's probably, you know, where that came from. And then with the passing of Eugene Lee 2 years ago, a space, if you will, opened up for, you know, other people to be brought in for recognition. And Keith Raywood, our, you know, head designer now, decided that was, you know, for me. And I really appreciated it, still appreciate it to this day. I never expected to be included. Even up until a few years ago, the film unit didn't get any credit. And now when they do run the credits, you'll see our names. So, you know, it's been a slow and steady progress to being considered a legitimate part of the team.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think it's one of the things where John and I, we've been watching SNL forever, and we've definitely, you know, seen it throughout the years. And like, I think we've both noticed that we've probably mentioned in a few past episodes, like how like the look of the pre-tapes have like definitely gone up, you know, by leaps and bounds, especially in recent memory than it has in the past. I mean, we could just quickly go through some of the pre-tapes that you've worked on. You've worked on the Shrimp Tower pre-tape in the Josh Brolin episode. I'm Just Pete on the Pete Davidson episode. That was a huge one. That went viral. The Lake Beach on the Nick Bargatze episode. The Battle of the Sexes on the Jason Momoa, where you had Sarah Sherman's head fly off from a tennis ball. What else did you say? The Billie Eilish,
the Waffle House.
Waffle House, yeah. Another.
I mean, that's really like, because looking at that short, you would think that it would that they just found a real life Waffle House somewhere and then they shot it there. But no, that's like shot inside a studio.
Yeah, Waffle House and the Christmas Carol episodes were the ones submitted for the Emmy. So I had to, you know, just do my little write up about what I did on the show for those, you know, and that's what won us the Emmy. And also, fun fact, the dog on the counter is actually my dog. So,
Wow.
Yeah. Like I follow you on social media. I do notice you put you have your pictures of your dog on there quite a bit, we're a pro dog. We have a pro dog stance during the podcast. We always love dog pics.
That's good. Yeah. That's important. We've had a hell of a season. I think part of the new production value, if you've noticed, is since COVID, we have secured studio space. It happened out of necessity to keep us tested and in cadence when television was figuring out in the early days how to go back into production. And having a space and testing in and staying in cadence and blah 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 was the way that happened. But what the necessary evil of that was, we could no longer shoot on location for obvious reasons, because that stopped being a thing. And the mayor's office on film and television also took the opportunity to change some of its rules. So one of the ways that we were able to get permission to shoot on location before COVID was, paying the expedited fees to turn a permit around like overnight. And they stopped doing that during COVID. So even if we wanted to go back to our old business model of like, this calls for a bar and a bed, a two bedroom apartment, let's just shoot that on location. It took that option away. And, I think our crew really, really appreciates being able to work out of a studio every week. So while it's made my job harder, I was also, given the courtesy of having some extra crew. So we now have art director, we have assistant art director, people that are helping us with drafting. So the thing that makes it quite nice is that we have a team now, where prior to COVID, we were three completely, like the SNL film unit was run like a production company, and we had three jobs on the go at the same time. So three totally separate independent crews shooting three different scripts at the same time. Which is still very much the case. We have my unit, which is called Film Unit, and that just is by way of the fact that it used to be shot on film back in the day. And then, for keeping this fast and speedy without getting into the semantics, the mid-2000s, like around the time that I joined, around 2012, I joined in like the 37th season. So that was 2010, 2011, but around 2012, 2013, I think is when we merged the digital short unit with the film unit, and like the pre-tape department became a codified thing. That unit is called the Beast Unit, because it was like the A unit and the B unit, and then the B, working in comedy, we can always find a joke in something. So the B unit became the Beast Unit. And then we have the Ghost Unit, which was sort of like the invisible, they got stuck with the least exciting pieces, if you will. Like if a live sketch needed a little pre-tape, jump to, incorporate into the live sketch, or, sometimes the bumpers, or even the promos that you see on Tuesday, that was the C unit. Now it's called the Ghost Unit. But I would say now more than ever, are all three units are cranking out the equivalent production value kind of thing. You can't tell the difference anymore. Mm-hmm. You used to probably be able to, but you can't anymore. And I love that, you know. So we're all doing like really fully evolved pieces now. Whether all three air is a whole other thing, but for the most part, you know, the production value is equal.
What is that like when you spend you know, several days just scrambling to get everything set for a digital short, and then it doesn't end up even airing on the show? That's got to be frustrating.
Oh yeah, I mean, but it's you know, it's par for the course. I mean, things legitimately get cut for time. Very rarely does the show, you know, air the three pieces. But I think the reason why Lorne is happy to spend the resources on the pieces is because they definitely have a sustainable life outside of the show. You know, they keep the show relevant. They fit quite comfortably into the way people consume their content now, which is short, bite-sized clips, you know, and, you know, for example, my colleagues, you know, last week had the Papyrus sketch, and Dave McCary came back to direct that. You know, that it was literally a reunion. And so the Ghost Unit had shot that years prior, and it was them that was going to shoot it again. And it needed to be a 9-minute piece. And there is no place on the live show for a 9-minute piece. And so they were really taking a risk by saying, well, you know what, I'd rather have full creative control over how long I want it to be and forego it airing. And I think that was a really smart decision, because the people that want to see that sketch, you know, when you look, the comments are just unbelievable. They're hysterical. I mean, people were so chuffed to see that and see it in its length. And you know, I think that was a really good creative decision. So I like when Film Unit goes rogue and does, you know, something that people aren't even used to, or it's unexpected, you know?
Yeah. And it's nice that, you know, now that there's an active YouTube channel, so there is a place for these cut for time sketches to go when they don't end up in the show itself. They're not just forgotten for the rest of time.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So. Hey, let's get back into your backstory a little bit. Like, how did you get into production and design in the first place? Is this something, have you always been like an artistic person? You've always had a passion for it. You go to school for this. Like, how do you, I always love a good origin story. So.
Yeah. No. I have a kind of like the backdoor way of getting into the film business. It's funny. I didn't even know what I do for a living existed, you know, when I was quote figuring it out. You know, I'm a, you know, New Yorker. I'm 53 years old. I was born in 1970 at the tail end. You know, my parents are first generation Bronx, you know, kids of immigrants and public school teachers. And yeah, I was the artistic kid. Definitely, you know, struggled in school. You know, I went to Catholic school my whole life. So I knew I was an artist early on, and luckily, you know, my parents being teachers really encouraged that with lessons and stuff. But, you know, having a Catholic education, you're not really getting exposed to a foundation of the arts. Like, you know, if I was a kid that, you know, had the opportunity to go to like Fame School or, you know, like a more public school, broader, you know, liberal arts programs. But, you know, nonetheless, I managed to get into FIT. So, you know, my college, you know, years were now completely the opposite of a kid growing up in Westchester. But one of the things that I was, you know, always a fan of and exposed to and saw early on was street art and graffiti. You know, my dad was a teacher at DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. So on like school holidays, I used to go and just watch these giant pictures on the train go by. I loved you know, I loved people performing, and I loved, you know, watching what that was, but also, you know, not being much of a music or, you know, an acting type person. I didn't really see myself fitting into those places. And it was always just like visual storytelling. Like, how am I using pictures to tell some sort of story? And so I'd studied what was called then commercial art. I was like the last generation of kid to learn pre-computer art making. So like mechanical paste up, and the graphic arts was all done analog, cut and paste. And I learned, you know, proper photography. I studied illustration in college, and then I studied fashion design with a focus on accessories, which was great, because that taught me how to take an idea, turn it into a two-dimensional drawing, make a pattern for it, and produce a three-dimensional object. You know, again, all done by hand back then. So, great foundations for what I do now, but I didn't enjoy those industries, you know, as a young person. I then went back to school in my mid-20s and tied everything up in a fine arts degree. And I really enjoyed murals and large format painting and whatnot. One of the things that happened to me early on in, you know, my early days of New York is I was, you know, it's the late 80s, and street art graffiti had transitioned from the trains onto the walls, and it was very much a game. So I was in that game. I was given a name. I did my thing. I had fun with it. I also liked what was starting to transition into street art, and people were doing wheat pasting, and there was politics involved, and there was all sorts of stories being told on the streets back then. I enjoyed that. And one of the things that I did in my last year of my undergraduate was we were offered a studio program. And the studios were in a building that was next to a photography studio. The photography studio used to throw away their flats at the end of jobs. And for the layman, flats are the walls that we use to make sets out of. And so every week there would be a fresh crop of these 4-foot by 8-foot walls in the garbage that I would just say, why would you throw this perfectly good surface for painting away? And so I would alter the sizes of them, but I would basically hoard flats in my studio. And I was doing these graffiti portraits of my friends, or just telling these stories, you know, using loaded materials like shoe polish and markers and spray paint to illustrate my stories. And then I would peek in the studio and I was like, oh, wow, that's how they set these walls up. They use jacks, and jacks is like a triangular shaped. Think of the back of a picture frame, how you get a picture frame to stand up. And that's pretty much that, like a larger format apparatus of what we use to stand up the flats. And then sandbags are placed on those. And then lights are placed in front of the flats to illuminate the scene that they're shooting. So when I did finally start to show my work, I was, I pulled it off the wall and set it up on the floor. And, you know, sure enough, some people from the industry, some art directors, production designers came to my show and said to me, oh, you work in the industry. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And they're like, oh yeah, this is, you know, these are flats and those are jacks. And, you know, do you have any interest? Do you want to paint sets? And at that point, you know, I'm not selling my huge paintings to anyone. I'm doing this work for free. I'm about to graduate into the world of, you know, what it's like to be an artist. And I don't, you know, I'm not good on the business end, so I don't see how this is possible. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll take any work right now. And so I got hired as a scenic artist and fell in love with being told what to do. And then the whole hip hop music video was a thing. And so, you know, when people found out I had a graffiti background, I used to get hired to do spray painted portraits of rappers, or just, you know, just readable graffiti, or, you know, layers of tags, or whatever, you know, whatever the treatment was. So I definitely was able to be part of that world where, you know, graffiti was now, you know, part of the art direction. And kind of never looked back. I jumped into the art department with two feet. I loved painting scenery. Union membership was super gatekeepy back then. And so, you know, to keep myself working, I learned all of the different departments within the art department. Fabrications, because, you know, I had some sculpture background, so fabricating was very easy for me, or, you know, shopping. I absolutely love being able to shop for things. And, you know, eventually I started assisting designers as an art director. One of the things that I had to go back to school to learn was, you know, drafting. I didn't ever have a mechanical drawing or a drafting background. So that was definitely something that I had to learn. But it's been the most wonderful process. I love the fact that I didn't come from a film school, because I feel like, you know, I got to learn on the job. And I didn't live in mistakes or problems for too long. You know, there was always a solution that, you know, there was always a way to learn, or to learn from other people. It's been pretty fantastic.
Wow, that's great. Now, could you walk us through what a typical week at SNL is like, if there is such a thing? I understand, yeah. Like you don't come in until Wednesday after the sketches are written, of course.
Correct. Yep. Monday, I think, is like the meet and greet day for writers and stuff. We have nothing to do with Monday. We have nothing to do with Tuesday. That's all, like, you know, that's all the sort of upper creative show, you know, words being written on paper kind of thing. And then on Wednesday is when the sort of key people in film unit start, and meaning, you know, our DPs, our production designers and set decorators, as well as our production teams, our art director, our assistant art director, they start as well. And we get scripts. I would say we get a little leak email at about noon, 1 o'clock on Wednesday, with these are being presented in the pre-tape package, and it's anywhere from 3 to 10, maybe 12 scripts. It is not officially released until about 3 or 4 o'clock, that these are our pre-taped sketches being presented for table read. And those also change a lot in that time, but we basically read and digest what it is that we're being asked to do at that time. And it can, like I said, it can change, and it typically does. We don't actually get picks until, I would say, not between 9 and 10 p.m. on Wednesday.
Oh.
And by the time we're getting on a Zoom call, which is also one of the great benefits of COVID, was they used to bring us to 30 Rock for dinner meeting. And we used to like eat our dinner and read scripts, and then have this production meeting once picks came through at, you know, 10:30. Back then they came a little bit earlier. They came between 8:30 and 9 o'clock. I think with COVID and a lot of people zooming in, that it picks became much later. So, you know, now, like I said, you know, we're just getting into the meat and potatoes of what the script entails at like 10:30 at night mm-hmm. on a Zoom call.
Now, just a quick question. Do you ever have a chance to choose which sketch or which pre-tape you're working on, or is that just assigned to you randomly?
It is assigned to me randomly. Our executive producer is a woman by the name of Dina Moles, and what Dina will sometimes do is group text all the designers, like, is this too much, and like too much with quote marks around it, like mm-hmm. meaning is this you know, is there something about this script that makes this really impossible to pull off in our time frame? And so what that means is that she either presents it to the writers, like, you have to edit, if you want us to do this in our time frame, then you have to edit this down. And you know, that a lot of times will make it go away. You know, there is a little bit of influence that we can have prior to, but not really.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But have you ever had a bit where it's like, oh, gee, I really wish I could have worked on that sketch instead, because I have a real feel or a real affinity for that material?
Oh, yeah. I get sketch envy all the time. But then I also, mm-hmm. you know, but then also, too, it's like I've been fortunate enough along my career to get some really incredible pieces. And, you know, my colleagues always kid around with me, and they'll be like, oh, we're so glad that your team got that piece, because we don't know how the hell we would pull that off, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's horses for courses, and everybody gets their day in court at Film Unit. So,
right. Okay. Right.
Fair enough. And a quick question. So also, how often do sets get, you know, recycled? Like, I imagine there's like a big warehouse where you kind of keep all the sets, for like, if there's like a set where it's just, you know, a living room or something.
The way our Film Unit works is we have a bunch of stock scenery that we call our scenery is manufactured at the Brooklyn Navy Yard at a shop called Stiegelbauer Associates, and Stiegelbauer has been historically linked to SNL since, you know, the very early days, and you know, they're one of the shops that NBC uses quite frequently. So there's a long storied history there. And over, you know, when I started out in the Lonely Island, like halfway point of the Lonely Island digital short days, mm-hmm. the show's designers used to design all of the scenery for all of the show. And if the pieces were a little bit intense, or, you know, had a lot going on, or, you know, even something as simple as the fickleness of the design department wanting to deal with, you know, anything pre-taped, they would tell the producers to bring in an outside person. So yeah. I was the outside person. And in those days, what the truck was delivering versus what I was seeing on the drawing was, you know, not for me to decide. And over time, it started to prove itself to the folks in charge that it would be better if we were in charge of the design for the pieces, and the live show designers could focus on the live show. Mm. And so, over time, one of the things that, you know, I pride myself in that we've done over the course of time is make this a well-oiled machine. And so having stock scenery to pull from, keeping things that are repeat offenders, engineering ways to pop sets up that, you know, edit down the amount of seaming together that we have to do with scenic work, like, you know, getting rid of, you know, the joins and the sets, and, you know, just really, really, what I say, quick and dumb ways to tell the story.
Right.
Yeah. So we definitely have a library, a catalog of scenery, but, you know, there is that still leaves a ton of building that has to happen. And then if we have three pieces going on, our film unit team that builds our sets is just, you know, they're inundated that Thursday morning, because, you know, going back to the timeline. So Wednesday, 10 o'clock, we get our picks and, okay, film unit has, you know, they're doing a nightclub, a two-bedroom apartment, an entry doorway, and then a little scene on a boat. So that's, you know, what, four or five sets. And then Ghost Unit got the music video. So they're doing music video Void, and then they have to do like little, you know, vignettes, four vignettes, you know, a cafe, a picture car, taxi ride, you know, a kid's playground, and then, you know, a deli. And then the Ghost Unit got, you know, they're doing a mock talk show. And so they have to do a big, like, Maury Povich-inspired set. So, you know, that still is a lot of scenery, a lot of specific scenery. Like, we're actually referencing something from history or from popular culture that now needs to be translated into set. So, you know, while, yes, we can use our stock flats as the bones of the sets, we're, you know, we are starting literally from scratch with the design.
Right. Because, like, that would be something like on the Dakota Johnson episode when they did that, like you said, like, You Are Not the Father, Maury Povich type of talk show, that you have to, like, kind of tailor it to look like the old Maury Povich show.
Yep, exactly. And so, yeah, like, we're, you know, by the time we get off our Zoom call on Wednesday night, it's now just gone Thursday. And that's when, you know, the drafting begins. What we try to do now, we all work in a program called SketchUp. And what we try to do is, when we jump on the Zoom call, have a very, very basic SketchUp model of what the main set is going to look like. And it's really great to be able to present a model on a Zoom call. And, you know, the DP can be like, I really am hoping, can we have a little bit of a ceiling on that? Cause I definitely want to shoot, you know, this and on, you know, and this sort of field of view, or I want a crane, or, you know, that kind of thing. A lot of stuff gets ironed out. So if we can cobble together a SketchUp model and present that on our Zoom call, it's so helpful to everyone involved. We also save our models too, at like the same way that we save our a lot of our sets. So you know, we can pull basic rooms out from the past and, you know, flip them over and stick the door on a different side, or get rid of the windows if that school auditorium now needs to turn into a factory or whatever. So, you know, we present a model, we talk about what it is we need, and then, you know, Wednesday night into Thursday morning becomes the drafting portion of the exercise for us. And then I tend to peace out around 3 o'clock in the morning because I need to get a little bit of sleep.
Right.
I'm the one that goes to the shop on Thursday morning. I go to Stiegelbauer and I make sure that all three units' drawings are understood. I meet with our assistant art director, Abby. You know, she is in charge of keeping all of the scenery separate and on its own, their own trucks going to our facility, you know, making sure that everything stays in the world of Film Unit, Beast Unit, and Ghost Unit. And then, you know, what'll happen is I leave the scenery shop around 7:30, 8 in the morning, and I drive right to our West 66th Street studio. And we have a tech scout at 9:30 in the morning, means that we go into the space that we're shooting in with our keys, and we talk about the draftings that everybody got sent in the middle of the night. And we decide if the way it's mapped out on our plan overview, or spotting plan, as some people call it, if it makes sense how we have it under the grid, or if it needs to be moved, or should we flip that, or sometimes, like with the Barbie sketch, you know, the set actually proved to be too big, and they're like, let's reduce it by 20%. So that was like a full redraft that I had to do at Tech Scout. And now, you know, granted, we've already pulled trigger at the scenery shop at 6 a.m. for stuff to get built. So, you know, hold the presses, guys. Okay, we're going to reduce the scale and scope of this. You know, what have you built so far? Okay, great. We'll keep that, you know, send that. Definitely do that. But you don't have to build this. Or can you make that much smaller? So much gets ironed out on Thursday from the hours of like Tech Scout 9:30 to about 3 p.m. And then to add fun to the mix, our rewrites typically come at about, rewrite starts at noon on Thursday. And wow. So, you know, I'll get scripts anywhere from about 1 p.m. to 4 or 5 p.m. Sometimes we don't even get the scripts. We just get a punch list from our producers of what the new stuff is. Now, granted, if there's things like model making or food styling or, you know, inflatables or, you know, whatever falls under the gamut of comedy in our script sometimes is in the script early on. And then there's a real fundamental change. You know, things that are very much in progress or built already get cut or morph into something even more complicated. So we really, really have got like pivot built into our genetics.
Yeah.
I mean, do you ever get something as radical as like, hey, the diner from this pre-tape is now going to be a dog pound. So just, you know, just change it around.
I mean, that does happen from time to time. And I think one of the things that all of our, you know, us designers are good at is being able to do a flip mo, you know, just being able to pivot and be like, all right, well, yep, it's not the way we intended, but, you know, we could surely change that into this. Or, you know, sometimes for the psychology of everyone, we're just like, just, I know they built the kindergarten and it's not even that anymore. Now it's like you said, a pet store. Just send it anyway. And our crew guys will figure out what pieces we need. Like I've seen whole sets that were cut, but already built, just stay on the carts in the loading dock and not even see the light of day.
Wow.
Yes. So it's just, you know, it's just par for the course.
Well, there's actually a couple of sketches, at least two I could think of that I know you've worked on, Andrea, that I really would like to know more about because they're just phenomenal. I would say, because we talked about these two sketches, John, on the podcast, like how impressed we were by them. And that's the Grouch sketch on the David Harbour episode.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, Mario Kart, Pedro Pascal.
Yeah.
That, like, again, we've been watching SNL for a while, but the Mario Kart sketch, that was next level when we saw it. We were like, I've never seen anything like this on SNL before. This is like, this is exceptional. This is it's really blowing my mind here.
Yeah, and full disclosure, we actually were given an extra day. Like, Mario Kart was definitely something that everyone knew it needed to have the production value of, you know, big. And that one, it was really more for VFX to build all of what you saw virtually. You know, being able to decide that, you know, this has a very overgrown post-apocalyptic feeling to it. So I think we need to shoot on blue screen rather than green screen. There was a lot of things that were introduced into the mix for that in terms of just being offered the extra day, which made the production value that much better on it. The other one that you said, the Joker. Yeah, the Joker. We didn't get extra time on the Joker. And that was pre-COVID. So, you know, we had the opportunity to find a studio that could offer both interior and exterior grit and grime. So, you know, we shot that at my friend's stage called the 1896, which is a sound stage, but it also is very much, it kept a lot of the raw factory feeling in it. And, you know, that we were able to, you know, build physical sets within the space and use the location and go outside on the street as much as possible.
Yeah,
that was a really amazing sketch because it really emulated the look of the movie, and it was, and, you know, it was also very impressive from a costume standpoint as well because you're building all these live action Muppets basically.
Oh yeah, no, it's a great one.
Yeah, now I know a limitation that the people work under for the live sketches is that they have to. I understand they have to have. Make sure that all the flats and set pieces have to be able to fit on the elevators at 30 Rock. Is that a limitation that you have to work under at all since you're in a separate studio?
We have a really huge freight elevator system. Yeah. Mm. We don't have to deal with, you know, some of the, excuse my French, but fuckery of 30 Rock, you know, being that, you know, 30 Rock was built for radio days, and so
right,
you know,
right,
like that's where that comes from, so we're very fortunate.
I just want to say the fuckery of 30 Rock, that's a great title for somebody's memoir.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, absolutely. That's somebody take that and run with it.
Yes. Yeah. Any disenchanted SNL employees out there want to take that for the title of their memoir?
Yeah, oh yes, it said no one ever, right? No.
I'm sure everyone there is absolutely happy all the time.
Mm, absolutely.
So I was also wondering. I guess you have like with all these things you've done for the show. I don't know if you have any like cool stories you'd want to share, or did anything like I don't know. Do you have any like crazy memories of things that happened on this? On the building.
It's like I wouldn't even know where to begin. I mean, you know, like my favorite, you know, interactions was how, you know, like how I was able to, like, so I'm married to a punk by way of London, you know, came up during, you know, saw the Sex Pistols at an early age, and it made an impression on him, and, you know, he became a musician and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, the history of punk for me, it was one of the more endearing, you know, like really closely connected pieces that I've had a chance to do. And, you know, like I was able to introduce Fred Armisen to my husband, and it's my husband's vintage Vivian Westwood clothing that's in the piece. And, you know, like that's a whole podcast in and of itself. And that particular film unit short inspired the creation of Documentary Now on the IFC channel. You know, so these kind of mockumentaries that turn into a more fleshed out, you know, episodic thing, you know, just there's so many, the connective tissue of the creative things that happen in that piece, you know, are just so, you know, exciting to me. And I love that, you know, these little comedy bits that, you know, if you sneeze, you could miss on the scheme of popular culture, but you know how they've led to other things along the way. And you know, just being able to really connect with the cast members when they write a script that's near and dear to their heart, like Sarah Sherman, you know, one of the first things she wanted to do early on was meet me. And I'm like, why does Sarah want to meet me? And my boss said, well, she wants to meet you because she thinks in pre-tapes, and you know, she's got a lot of scripts written for this kind of stuff. And she understands that, you know, some of these things might need more time. So she wants to be able to to speak with you about, you know, engineering some of her scripts. And yeah, like that's just amazing to me that, you know, that we matter, you know, to folks.
Yeah, wow.
No. Well, I mean, I can definitely see how her stuff could be more involved because she's like very into the body horror and,
oh yeah,
you know, she does things that are more special effects heavy. People are losing their heads and having skin tags that talk and
100%, 100%.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I do love how like music is such a big important part of you and your life. Like I actually watched the show reel for your production design company.
Oh wow.
I went a bit of a deep dive and I saw you had that Devo song playing in the background. I was like, I respect that. I respect that.
Yeah.
Uncontrollable Urge, hell yeah. I'm with that.
That's awesome.
It's fantastic. And I also saw in the show reel you had clips from Great Day, the Lonely Island.
I cut that reel. Like the first one was not a big one on the scheme of digital shorts. It was called Booty Call, and it was with Alicia Keys, and you know Andy Samberg is seemingly on an intimate, shall we say, phone call with Alicia Keys, only to reveal that he's actually having an intervention, like a rehab style intervention. So the whole gag, you think it's one thing and then it's revealed in the end that this is actually happening. And it was called Booty Call. It was shot in, I think we shot it in a hotel. So we had to take a corner and make it intimate and dark and candles and then, you know, reveal that they're in kind of a soulless hotel room. You know, like a conference center, you know, Andy Samberg's getting an intervention bestowed upon him. That was the first one. And I literally got the call. So it was in the middle of the housing economic crisis in 2009, 10. And I had started a business which failed due to the climate at the time. And I put my name on the availability list. I was just far enough out of New York City with this business endeavor that I'd started to take me away from day playing projects. I was known for a lot of like, you know, you can call me on the morning of and I'll show up on set and fill whatever, you know, whatever aspect you need me to fill. Also, too, worth a mention, around the time that I got into the union was the time when the unions decided to open up the type of work that they were covering under a collective bargaining agreement. So that included music videos and reality shows. Oh, and, you know, you'll know anything about those two genres is that, you know, that's not a highly desired piece of, like, people do not want those jobs. They want to work on commercials, majors agreements, films, you know, episodic. Those are the better paying work. And any people that were established in those worlds didn't want, you know, an 18-hour day music video. They didn't want running and gunning through the streets of New York City following, you know, housewives and whatever have you. And that those were the only jobs that I was doing in my non-union work. So then when I finally did get into the union, now that work was being covered with union contracts. So it was really great for me. But there wasn't a lot of that work at the time. And, you know, with the financial crisis, you know, New York dried up. The tax incentive thing hadn't started. So, you know, I put my name on the availability list for the union, and my boss, Dina, you know, got my name off of the list and gave me a call. So it was literally, you know, a matter of luck that I got the job at SNL. I was literally available, and she called me up and she said, "Hi, I'm, you know, so-and-so. I am a producer at SNL, and I need," she said, "I need an art decorator." And I'm like, "Okay, do you need an art director or a set decorator?" And she says, "Yes." And I'm like, "Okay, when do you need me?" And she's like, "When can you get here?" And I said, 20 minutes. And I hopped on a train and I was at 30 Rock in 20 minutes. And only to find out, you know, in a few hours, I was going to be in a hotel room with Alicia Keys. And wow. That's literally how I got the job. And Dina says that I was the best hall call she ever made in her life. So, you know, here we are.
And what day of the week was that?
That was Thursday.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah. they were getting into crunch time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, back then you used to get the call on Thursday. So what I did, I loved the job so much. And I just, and they called me back. The one I did after that was Great Day. And I was like, this is awesome. I want this work. And so I just used to look at the SNL schedule and see when they were actually, you know, in reruns or shooting, you know, if they actually had a show that week. And I would try to just make my Thursday and Friday available because, you know, the liability of an SNL show week, it literally means Thursday, Friday. That's it. It never changes. We only ever have Thursday to prep and Friday to shoot. And then the show's on Saturday. And that is never going to change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Wow. Do you ever go to the studio to watch the show live? Or are you just happy to wash your hands of it by that point after the intense 2 days?
I would say the latter tends to be, you know, as much, you know, and there was even a moment when I was, you know, being offered a position on the live show as one of the designers. And as much as I thought I could make that work, it just worked out to be the fact that, you know, it's pretty intense. And by Friday, there was a time in like season 39 where I was doing all three units, you know, when whenever it was unofficially like, you know, I have to manage everything. And then slowly over time, as the production value grew, you know, it was time to bring in colleagues and people to oversee their own script. And, you know, like I said, up until COVID, you know, we were doing all of the design and drafting ourselves. It's always been an intense amount of work. And as much as we'd like to align ourselves with the live show, it's best kept parallel universes. By Saturday, I'm usually waking up with a migraine, and I couldn't imagine actually having to go and work on the live show. And then also too, you know, so much for the live show gets ironed out in Thursday and Friday and blocking, and, you know, live broadcast is a totally separate animal to, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, pre-taped content, you know, down to cameras and lighting and how scenery gets built. So yeah, I don't have any business having anything to do with the live show while I'm overseeing the pre-tape department.
I'm just looking at your work from season 39 right now. And there are some memorable sketches that you worked on in that one. Just to name a few, there was Dyke and Fats, mm-hmm. Which is a favorite of mine because it's so quick and it's so hilarious. And, you know, I just love it. And, you know, the Chicago accents are wonderful. But, you know, the look of that is great, too, because it looks like an 80s cop show. It looks like an mm-hmm. episode of Cagney and Lacey. Mm-hmm. Another one was Twin Bed, which must have been an interesting challenge because I'm sure you had to build like five separate bedrooms for that.
Yeah.
Because it was all about the ladies of SNL bringing their boyfriends home for the holidays.
Yep. So fun fact, that'll give me an opportunity to introduce my colleagues. So my colleagues are Ken McLeod and Mark Newell. And so mm-hmm. Twin Bed is how I officially met Ken McLeod because I don't remember what the other piece was, but it was all shot on location somewhere. Maybe it was the Jesus piece.
The Quentin Tarantino.
Tarantino, yeah, Django.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, when Christoph Waltz was hosting.
Yeah, I think I think those happened on the same show, although I could, everything turns into a blur when I'm put on the spot and asked to remember something. But there was something that I had to do that was super intense. And Twin Bed was also happening. So it was the decorator at the time that I was working with exclusively, Kim Kachugan. She said her boyfriend was a production designer. And I said, well, I said, it might be a great opportunity to bring him on because I can't oversee the build for this and the build for my thing. And, you know, I basically brought in somebody cold, you know, threw up all over them a set of like how we do things in SNL, which is totally different to how actually production designers work in the real world. threw them into
so unlearn mess. Everything you know yep. from your training.
Yep. Here you go. Here's the mess. Make sense of it. Bye. that's just kind of how it's, you know, to talk about design by fire, like that's literally how you get brought into the mix. And if you can stick it out and you love it and you find it enthralling and exciting, then it, you know, you tend to stick around. But there are plenty of people that have been thrown into our mess and are like, F that. I don't want anything to do with that. Like that is garbage. Or what, like, you know, the joke on set is we're in day two of a 5-day build. Because sometimes it feels like that, like you're just like you can't see the forest from the trees and you're like, how is this ever going to get done? But it gets done because we have to start shooting, not because it's ready.
Yeah. Yeah. The famous Lauren saying that the show goes on not because it's ready. It goes on because it's 11:30.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Twin Bed. That was the Jimmy Fallon episode. Fallon. If that helps ring a bell.
Yeah. I still can't remember what was pulling me in other direction.
Well, there must have, and another notable thing from season 49 was the Wes Anderson horror trailer, the Midnight Odiary of Sinister Intruders, which I mean, that was really a technically impressive because I mean, you're basically making a bunch of Wes Anderson sets and it's shot in the style of a Wes Anderson film. And I mean, you guys nailed it.
Also one of the near and dear to my heart. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. I mean, part of how like season 39 was, you know, presented to me. So, you know, I was offered the position as production designer in season 38. You know, it was like made official that I was going to come in on Wednesday and read scripts and get my head around things, and then, you know, Thursday morning, we used to location scout, believe it or not. So I'd be drafting through the night. I wouldn't go home. I would just stay at 30 Rock because I knew that the crew van was going to be leaving 30 Rock at like 8:30 or 9 o'clock so we could go scout locations for things. Sometimes I'd have to run on two or three. But the way it was marketed to me, in the early days of when we were starting to really find our footing with big production value was that one was always going to be the super dominant one, and it was going to, chances are, be the film unit piece. And, you know, by, I'd say season 38 is when the digital shorts morphed into the film unit as well. And, you know, after, I don't think we did too many digital shorts after the 100th. Like, you know, the guys were, you know, starting to make their exodus. So, you know, it was always like, we're going to have one really big piece and then like maybe a smaller, still running and gunning through the halls of 30 Rock or, you know, finding a little studio within 30 Rock and doing a small set. You know, so it was always kind of marketed to me that there was going to be one that I just kind of needed to oversee. And then the stagehand crew could put the set together and get them through the shoot and I didn't need to be there. So it wasn't like it started out being massive. And then, you know, it wasn't until like season 39 where, you know, the Beast unit really started to get scripts that were paralleling the film unit. And now everybody was really interested in writing, you know, some in-depth content for these pre-tapes.
Now, I know you've been involved with like several of the Lonely Island shorts, and kind of the equivalent of those guys today is that we have Please Don't Destroy. Or do you have any involvement with Please Don't Destroy stuff, or do they just go off on their own and do their stuff?
The PDD pieces have been shared between the Beast and the Ghost Unit. And yeah, and at one point too, it was like there was they were going to possibly become the fourth unit, and it was really just revealed early on that we didn't have the infrastructure for it to be four units. But yeah, a lot of hope was placed on them very, very early on that this was going to be the, you know, another contender for legacy. And yeah, they've really proven to be, you know, hilarious and important, and, you know, they kill, they absolutely kill. But yeah, we just made it work within the three units. And now, like I said, it's kind of shared between Ghost and Beast.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
And I mean, it's also speaking of legacy, I also see you also work with Akira Yoshimura, who has been with the show like forever. So, I mean,
live show legacy. I mean, like, yeah, to be associated with some giants, you know, some revered production design folks. I mean, you know, Eugene Lee. College courses on production design are taught about Eugene Lee, you know, so I'm very fortunate to, you know, keep the company of these folks.
Is there like a particular sketch or two where you had like just an immense challenge and you really thought, I don't know if we can pull this off, and then somehow you did at the time? Could you talk about that, about what the biggest mountain to climb was between Wednesday and Friday?
It's always that. I don't come with that muscle. I don't come with no. I think one of the reasons why I probably have my job there is because of that. I'm trying to think in edited shapes of how we can pull that off. And I think that the team of people that, you know, what I call our art department, is also thinks that way. It always feels like this is unattainable, and we are always constantly screwing ourselves because we pull it off. And then the asks become ridiculous. And so like, we're always talking about, you know, like, what would be the most impossible thing that we could be presented on a Wednesday night? And we always joke around like, a German pharmacy amusement park underwater, you know, like just like things that would require like an insane amount of graphic design in terms of insane on top of it, you know, an insane amount of building, you know, special effects engineering, you know, just like, I'm sure it will happen in the near future, but at the same time too, there's enough intelligent folks on the front end of this to know, you know, what we're capable of pulling off. Or, you know, we flat out said, you know, we would need another day to actually get that to happen. So I think sketches do die because what's being asked isn't attainable. But luckily it's, you know, it's not my job to say no or to produce that.
Right. Right. Now, you said earlier that you use this program SketchUp to do your set designs, and I'm sure that saves you a lot of time. When did you guys make the transition into using SketchUp rather than doing like more traditional hand-drawn blueprints, which have been the industry standard for a while?
Well, yeah. I mean, the fact that the live show still hand drafts their sets is a bit of an anomaly. It's not really.
Wow. I had no idea they did that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. It's not really how, stuff is done nowadays, although they have a young designer on their team, Melissa Shaken, and, she came on a few years ago, and she is a master draftsman. She works in AutoCAD, and so it's so interesting to see the drawing packages that come in to the shop on Thursday, because I can always see her version versus the other designers. Joe Tullio, like Leo, and Keith, hand draft. That works for them. It doesn't work for us because I think early on I figured out at the time when I was offered the position, I felt the need to draft in Vectorworks because it was the closest thing to hand drafting in terms of, plan and elevation views of how the design packages were presented for construction drawings. And so, I was doing the drawings, I was doing the modeling in SketchUp for me, just so I could get my head around what it would look like in time and space. And then I would redraft everything in Vectorworks because back then the two programs didn't speak to each other. Mm-hmm. Everything, of course, now, you can save 2D or 3D objects and, everybody plays quite nicely together in the sandbox, but that wasn't always the case. It just ended up being way too much work in the middle of the night. And as soon as I'd learned layout, which is the CAD viewport program within SketchUp, once I learned that and now I could turn my 3D model into a 2D construction drawing, it was like manna from the heavens. It just brought a speed to the process. One of the things that makes, us move so fast and furious in the middle of the night is being able to work like that. And all of the designers use that because of the speed and, and just it's just a language that flows really well for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fantastic. Okay. I think we're going to probably wrap it up in a bit, but before we close out, it's one more question. So if somebody was interested in getting into production design, what would you maybe advise them to do? Like, what does it take to to sort of tough it out and prosper in this field? Like, what would you give, a young and upcoming upstart? Would you give?
Yeah. I do. I take on a lot of young people, for that reason. One of the ways that I get back at the gatekeeping and some of the problems that the industry has. I mean, don't get me wrong. I find the film business to be one of the more democratic and diplomatic, industries to get into. I've seen kids from the project start out as like lowly PAs. Humping gear off the back of a truck, schlepping and doing like some really, really tireless, just difficult work, figure out where they want to be in the departments of the business and be there within a year. Like I've seen that more like, never, ever be horrible to a PA. Not that I have that in my nature, but I'm always, I always remark that person could potentially be your boss one day. And I've seen it happen. Mm-hmm. Does the kid from Tisch School of the Arts or Yale or have more, connections? Possibly. Yeah. But you're starting out in the entry levels of the film business, kind of in the same position, whether you're going to learn on the job or you've got a belly full of film school. So, one of the ways that I like to get back at the business is to give people, that didn't have the opportunity to go to film school, or, you know, had a really rough time with it and getting into the industry. And the thing with art department is it really takes a special kind of person, because there, you know, it's very much, it involves a lot of hard work. I always say the recipe for the cookie is the same three ingredients. It's just the amount changes. So it's, you know, hard work, positioning oneself, and luck. And some people are really good at positioning themselves. They're not so great at the hard work, and they're super lucky, you know, and magic happens for them. But more often than not, it's the, you know, you basically do a load of hard work. You say yes to every job, even if it sounds like a shit show. And, you know, and then with the good graces of the heavens, you know, and your foot in the door, the luck thing happens, and you just get on this wonderful ride that takes you, you know, through the years. So I like to mentor people, and I can pretty much tell by just meeting a person and having them shadow me on set whether or not the art department is for them. I'm really good at sensing that, because it's like there's just a certain type of exuberance. There's a certain type of questions that people will ask. There's a really interesting set of parameters that I couldn't quantify what that is, you know, with you in now, but I just kind of know it when I see it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. That's fascinating. Well, thank you so much for this, enlightening conversation, Andre. Really, really fantastic stuff.
Thank you. Great to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know. I mean, usually at this time we ask our guests if they have anything to plug or promote. Don't know if you do. You know, please feel free.
If there's a place where people can follow you on social media.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
We could give Damage Studios a nice plug.
Yeah. At Damage Studios is, and then I have at SNL Film Unit Design. And I tried to, you know, I do enough different content that, you know, I'm like, all right, Damage Studios should be for like my dog pictures and, you know, like all of the different things that I'm working on, as well as SNL. I mean, people are, I think what happened on Damage Studios is I was focusing a lot on the Damage Studios stuff, and so many people were really interested in that. And then I had so much different content too that I was like, let me separate stuff. So, you know, so I did. And then I'm trying to work on one that has more of the legacy content, and, you know, I'm of the age where it's really hard for me to factor the time that you need to invest in social media to do it right, and the stories that I want to tell. I still struggle with it, but I try to keep both Damage Studios and SNL Film Unit Design up to speed. In terms of things that I want to plug, I'm super excited about this forthcoming show for Netflix is a Joke Festival out in Los Angeles. I'm doing John Mulaney's show, which is called Everybody's in LA.
Nice.
And it is going to be a hoot. There's a little bit of a teaser trailer on the YouTube right now that you can watch. And I'm going to leave it at that, because I don't want to disclose too much.
Oh, okay. And this is going to be his next comedy special?
Yeah, it's a live broadcast, and it very much takes the format of you know, of other things that he's done, but it is going to be a mostly live broadcast. So, and that is I want to say May 2nd.
Oh, okay, yeah, that's coming right up. Yeah. Okay, well, yeah, we'll be sure to check that out.
Fantastic, cool. Awesome. And that's our podcast, everybody. Thanks for listening, as always, to our episode. As always, you can follow us on the social media, that on Twitter, because we refuse to call it X, at SNL Nerds Show. And you can follow me on all the social medias, at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N, Credible.
And you can follow me on social media, at Trumbull Comic. That's T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L, and the word comic. And we will be back next week with another cool thing about SNL.
Right. So
until then, nerds out.
Nerds out.
Nerds out.
Okay. I think that about does it. So
yeah,
thank you
great.
So much.
Yeah, yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah,
and, we had a lot of fun. A lot of great information.
Let me know if there's ever like within the realms of Film Unit, if there's any other people you'd like to speak to, you know, like Ooh. Our directors, you know, just let me know.
I mean, I'd love to speak to Akira sometime if he's available, if he's willing.
The director, that would be fantastic too as well.
Mike Diva or Tim Wilkamy. I can reach out to Leo. Leo is super notoriously grumpy and not very talkative, but every once in a while he really rises to the occasion and he is a lovely human. So I will ask him if that's something that he's interested in.
Yeah, sure.
That'd be fantastic. Okay. Do you mind just staying on just for a few minutes? Because like, I think Trumbull has to shut off the recording and
when I stop the recording, just you just have to hang on the line for a few minutes for your audio to upload from your computer.
Sure.
So I'll stop the recording now.
Okay.
But thank you so much.
Of course.
Actually, there was also one question. I didn't know if I could ask or not, but like, so the diner Lobster Sketch, did you work on that or no? Because like, I know that's in studio. I didn't know if I could ask it on the podcast.
On which one?
The Diner Lobster.
The Diner Lobster. No, that was that was Melissa. Melissa designed that. That's that. Yeah. I think she did Bodega Cat and what was the other one? The other Mulaney sketch.
Airport Sushi?
Yeah. Airport Sushi. Okay. Yeah.
All right. I'm glad.
And then there was the one in the subway, too.
Subway Churro. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think there have been four of them now.
Yeah, they're really good. Those are some of my favorite live sketches.
I mean, those are just so technically impressive because they do so much in those sketches. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also saw that you worked on a Colin Jost movie, the Staten Island Summer.
Yes, I did. Wow. Yeah, yeah. I didn't design it. I was the art director because Paramount wouldn't allow somebody that didn't have, like, I don't have a lot of feature films under my belt. And so when you try to work out of genre, it is quite common for the production company to say we don't want to work with that person because they're not familiar with that content. So they brought me on as the art director. And then we ended up reshooting a huge portion of the film the next summer, and so I designed that bit. But yeah, that was a labor of love.
All right. Fantastic. Wow. But yeah, thanks again so much for doing this. Wow. This was a phenomenal episode. I really enjoyed it.
I always find it fascinating when we talk to the folks who work on the show and you find out just so much about how much goes into making the show and making the show happen. And it's like this impossible feat that you pull off every week somehow. Yeah. So
it's like you're doing you're pulling off a magic trick every weekend. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I extended the invitation and it's like, open anytime if you want to save it for next season for the 50th. But we always shoot on Friday. And so like, if you guys wanted to come down and just watch a Film Unit shoot happen and, you know, like two or three pieces being shot simultaneously in the same building makes it really easy now. So
that would be amazing. We would love to do that. Yeah, let's talk more about finding a time to do that.
Perfect.
We will take you up on that.
That would be great.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Yes.
Anytime.
Yes, we would love that. Okay. All right, I'm going to stop the recording. Go ahead, Darren.
No, I was just going to remind you about the stopping the recording.
Yeah, I'm going to stop the recording, so just hang on for a second because it'll just take your audio a few seconds to upload.
Okay.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.